Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Pat Christensen, author of Rock Vegas, Live Music Explodes in the Neon Desert. We'll be talking to Pat in a moment. We also have an extra guest host. Andrew Yule is a blackjack player and author who attends 5 or 6 live concerts a year, so that makes him well qualified to ask Pat questions about this. He has a blackjack book in the pipeline at the Las Vegas Advisor, so perhaps we'll be having him in the future in the guest chair. Andrew Yule, welcome to the host chair of Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here and get a chance to work with you guys. I'm excited.
Pat Christensen has been in the music venue business for some 35 years. He's managed both the Thomas & Mack Center as well as the Sam Boyd Stadium here in Las Vegas. Currently, he's president of an organization called Las Vegas Events and is assisted in securing 5 music festivals here in Las Vegas. Pat Christensen, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Yeah, good to be here.
All right, big question. How did the Grateful Dead, of all bands, revolutionize Las Vegas?
Well, the evolution of live music in Las Vegas started in the, started in the 50s. And it was very slow at first. It really wasn't until the early 90s, that we started to get some of the bigger acts in the stadium shows. And the reason that happened was the Grateful Dead. It wasn't because the Grateful Dead was the ideal audience for Las Vegas. It wasn't their ideal guest. But what it did is it opened the eyes of the rest of the touring business to the fact that Vegas wasn't just, the shows done in Vegas just weren't the locals. There was a chance to get tourists. So before that time, even with Thomas and Mack, we would, if we get 5%, maybe 10% visitors at our people from out of town that come to an Elton John show or Lionel Richie, that was a lot. So what the Grateful Dead did is it demonstrated that they would travel because 85, maybe 90% of that crowd was from out of town. So what we did is we took those pictures, the aerial shots of the Grateful Dead, and sent them around to different talent agents, different music agents. And the first one to bite was Paul McCartney. So we kind of used it as this is how we will sell more tickets, and it worked. Paul McCartney drew about 7,500 people from out of town, and we sold over 30,000 tickets to it. And then it was the Eagles. So the Grateful Dead from 91 to 95 did 14 shows. At the end, they were selling 130,000 tickets to those shows. But more importantly for us, it was kind of the impetus for the hotels to acknowledge the fact that live music could draw fans.
You just said that when Paul McCartney played, only 7,500 people were from out of town out of 30,000, so about 25%. If he were to play today, would those percentages be? I would think there'd be many more people from out of town.
90%.
In fact, nowadays it would be 90%.
In fact, if you look at all of the live touring business, probably the exception would be the stadium, but at T-Mobile, all of the theaters, you're looking at somewhere between 70 and 85% of the shows are from out of market. So the impact to the city is remarkably bigger than it used to be.
Pat, I just want to touch on the Grateful Dead again here just for a second. Now, I haven't been exposed to them much over the years. It seems like being a fan of theirs is almost like a whole separate lifestyle. What's the deal with that? Like, what makes them so influential and to draw such a following?
I think the performance itself, their shows would go on 3.5 hours. They never record. They never play the same song the next performance. They would play 3 performances in a row, so fans would travel to see them. But I think it was the whole lore of the Grateful Dead was this spontaneous bluegrass rock, new kind of music that just grew. And I think when Touch of Grey, their only hit, came out, that's when they elevated themselves to a stadium show. But it really became, the Deadheads, really became a traveling troupe for the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, I saw that comment. I can't remember his name, but somebody went to 880 shows or something like that.
That was Bill Walton.
Pretty tall guy.
That's amazing.
Now, I just met Andrew a few minutes ago, and just glancing at him, he does not strike me as a tie-dye kind of a guy.
I have to say, it was tremendously entertaining when the Dead first came to town. I mean, now when, like, Electric Daisy is here, or some of those, and you see lots of bizarre costumes and, you know, weird people, that was the first time I had ever encountered anything like that in Vegas. A lot of people just wasted on acid and stuff, wandering around the casinos, watching roulette wheels spin around for hours, you know. So it was a lot of fun when they started coming here.
It's interesting, the parallel between the Grateful Dead and EDC. The only real difference is the music. The music is much more energetic, and that's all it is. It's just energy. It's a lot of bass and a lot of music. Grateful Dead were more melodic, but it probably is the thing that demonstrates it the most is the drug of choice. Ecstasy and an exhilarating drug is EDC, whereas pot and
cocaine,
acid and things were more of the Grateful Dead. But when you look at the following, the EDC's got that same passionate following.
That's interesting.
When I went to a Paul McCartney concert, it was as a comp from a casino. And so the casinos buy however many they buy, and they give them to their players. Whether those players are local or tourist is not really something that you're tracking. It's just like, well, the MGM bought, 500 tickets or 5,000 or whatever it was. And so...
But I would think the majority of comps are going to go to out-of-town players.
Well, from the MGM, yeah. From if...
Right, not if it was comp from the South Point.
Right.
Yeah.
All right,
but they're still players.
Yes, yeah.
Changing subjects, how did the Thomas and Mack Center, which is the big auditorium at UNLV, how did that usher Vegas into the modern age of Touring X?
So again, this was all an evolution. Before that time, you had three venues, none of them bigger than 7,000 seats. You had the Aladdin, you had the Convention Center, and then the Sahara Space Center did some shows. So you really couldn't get the acts. There was no motivation for an act because the only thing they could gross would be 7,000. So the bigger acts didn't come to Las Vegas. When Thomas and Mack opened, you now had an 18,500 capacity. So you opened it up to a whole different level of act. And Lionel Richie, Billy Joel, acts of Van Halen. They wouldn't have played here, especially as their music exploded, because you didn't have the capacity. So the capacity of Thomas and Mack Center and the how the university and the city embraced live music.
Yeah, in my case, it was George Strait.
He was one of them.
And so... what memorable acts passed through here in the 80s?
So Thomas and Mack, again, you were getting so many acts. It probably doubled the number of live shows that were coming to Vegas, Thomas and Mack Center. But you did shows like Billy Joel, Lionel Richie, Van Halen. U2, their Joshua Tree tour, the first show of that tour was at Thomas and Mack Center. And then after that, there were four more stadium shows, actually one arena show and four stadium shows that played. Rod Stewart, Fleetwood Mac. The only ones that weren't coming then, because we weren't considered an A market yet. When MGM came on, that's when we ended up getting to be an A market. But so we weren't doing Neil Diamond.
The MGM Grand Arena is what
yes,
you're talking about.
When MGM Grand Garden opened with the new MGM, is when we took the next step. But we were getting so much better. In fact, that first 3 years, we probably averaged, Thomas and Mack probably averaged 22 rock concerts.
Wow, that's a lot. That kind of segues into another question we have about where Las Vegas stands today and among, like, competition with the other cities in live music.
We are the number one live music destination in the world. And I'll distinguish the two. We're not the number one live music market. We don't have 15 million people here to draw from every weekend or, every day. New York, Chicago, LA, probably a bigger live music market. But as in terms of a destination, people that travel for music, we don't have a peer. In that you have the residencies that have come back. I mean, Celine showed us, Celine and AEG and Caesars demonstrated that you could fill a 4,000-seat venue 60 times a year at a reasonable ticket price and a
unreasonable ticket price.
So then the residencies just grew from then. So I think the residencies set us apart from every other market.
And they've really come a long ways too. You're starting to see a lot of the newer acts in the residencies, like they're getting Backstreet Boys and Pitbull and Britney Spears, and it's not just those kind of 70s and 80s style artists anymore.
Although that's still a generation away, right? I mean, Britney Spears and
Beyonce is still current.
Yeah, but she doesn't have a residency.
Sort of, she does.
No, not yet.
I would say she's a few generations
J-Lo,
after
but
Celine.
Even J-Lo is, you know.
Yeah.
But I think they're more interested in attracting a little bit older crowd just because they gamble more than.
Well, what's interesting about what Planet Hollywood did is they didn't choose to compete with the same genre of music. They created their own niche, which is Britney Spears, J-Lo, Pitbull. They sprinkled Lionel Richie in there. So what Axis did at Planet Hollywood is created this different genre. Coliseum has their genre. The Park Theater has created a different... So they all have carved out these niches and created venues that are customized to those niches.
Rolling Stones has appeared here a number of times, and there's rumors that they're going to do a free concert on the Strip sometime, and you're somehow involved with that. Is there any truth to those rumors?
Well, we have to squelch that right now.
Okay.
In the book, I mentioned that the first thing I did when I came to when I took the Las Vegas events job is proposed to do the Rolling Stones on the Strip for free, and the board was interested. Unfortunately, what happened is the MGM Grand Garden looked at that and said, well, why would you guys subsidize an event that we're competing for? So the fact that that would have, that it would be free and that would that take up, yeah, it might be a great weekend for us, but it literally would compete with somebody that is trying to bring them to their own hotel. So that got squelched, and there is no Rolling Stones coming to Las Vegas on the show. I mean, the Rolling Stones grossed $7 million one night in T-Mobile. $7 million in one night at T-Mobile. They're
not.
It
takes me weeks to
make
it.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So no Altamont version 2?
No Ultimate.
Altamont?
Altamont. Oh, no. We don't. That had more to do with the rock and roll era and the kind of how naive they were then. But the Altamont, Altamont will never happen again.
Well, Hell's Angels make good security.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can just see a casino hiring the Hell's Angels as security.
Now, so you've been talking about bigger arenas, stadiums. They're smaller ones, like South Point is one of our sponsors, and they have a good-sized showroom, good quality, and several casinos have showrooms. How does that all factor into this situation?
It was interesting. I went to a Blues Traveler at the Cleopatra Barge, which I think seated 400.
Mm-hmm.
So the diversity of showrooms is all there. And I think what will happen is because the quality is so good, it's really up to the casino. And how do you want to, what customer do you want to market to? You have the venues for it. During the National Finals Rodeo, there isn't a showroom or space in South Point that isn't rocking after the NFR. So most of these venues are customized to whatever live music is going to be there is going to be customized to that crowd that's there that weekend.
And
You know, when I first moved to town, there were lounges in every casino where you could go see live music.
Good live music.
Really good. Really, really good live music. You know, every night of the week. And they were free. Sometimes they would have a drink minimum, but often they didn't. Is that just dead completely because they want to make profit on every square foot? Or
no, I think it's your market. I think the, again, my genre of music, when you know, was my heavy metal was Led Zeppelin. Well, heavy metal today is Metallica. So as generations evolve, what they're doing is using the showrooms for that customer. So the customer that might have gone to see that type of lounge music before really isn't interested in going to it. You don't have a big enough market for a hotel to do that. I mean, one part of the book that was really interesting is the musicians that were playing in the 70s and 80s for Sinatra and Dean Martin and even for Siegfried and Roy. You had a great generation of, we probably had the best musicians in the world in Las Vegas at that time playing in these bands. But then we went to the tape, the recorded music.
And it gives bands that may be openers on a large tour a chance to perform, you know, full sets for their fans and things like that, I think, too.
Yeah, again, you look at Brooklyn Bowl, House of Blues. There's a lot of smaller ones. It's, you're just not the lounge concept you had in the past.
Well, they're not free.
They're not free.
They're not always free. The South Point, for example, has...
That's one of the few, yeah.
Has Wes Winters in the Grandview Lounge a couple nights a week, and he plays the piano, sings, and there's a dance floor there, and that's... you can sit there for free if you want to.
Well, I think there's still a lot of lounge acts out there.
Yes.
For free, but they're a part of the whole entertainment plan. They're not as before. They used to be that in the showroom was it.
One of the big events that I found interesting in the book was you talk about Garth Brooks back in 98 and how he did the show for the next show for the same price. I saw him last year at the T-Mobile Arena. The tickets were slightly more than $18. I've just been curious about his fans. His fans seem to reach across so many genres. He's clearly a country star, but why do you think he reaches across so many different genres of fans?
You know, first of all, I don't think country as we knew it, it's country rock. It may not be the Allman Brothers or Marshall Tucker, but if you listen to country today, it's rock. And what Garth has done, I think the most impressive thing to me about Garth is how well he is in tune with his fan. I don't think there's another artist in the world that understands or works as hard for his fans. And I'll give you a couple examples. I think one you mentioned when we did the shows at Thomas and Mack, the first ones, he did three shows. And the last thing he did was... last thing he said is, I'm coming back. The next time I come back, I'm coming back to Thomas and Mack. He was very loyal to Thomas and Mack. And I'm going to play for the same price. Came back 5 years later, played an $18 ticket for four shows. The other thing he does...
Sold out in about 30 minutes.
Yeah. So the other thing he does is he does enough shows for all his fans. So it really takes away the broker's ability to be profitable. So let's say a Beyonce did that. And Beyonce priced her tickets at $85 to $100 and did six shows instead of one. You would, I wouldn't say you would eliminate the broker, but you would greatly reduce it, because what happens with live music, especially the upper, the Bruce Springsteens, is they don't want to price their ticket above $100 if they don't have to. So who makes the profit of the show? The broker. And so what Garth has done is he's kind of taken that out. And he's also, the way he goes on sale makes it very difficult for brokers to get their hands on tickets. So if you don't have, it's like if you have the yield management for a flight, if you know there's plenty of flights, then you're not, the price isn't going to go up. That's what's wrong with live music. We don't have, the artists do not want to play to the demand. They want to play one night, two nights.
Well, they make six times as much money if they, right? So.
Yep. And then again, they complain about the fact that, you know, the broker's out there taking a $100 ticket and making it $500 to $1,000.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And it's clear that some people just love to be on stage. When I first got to town, Willie Nelson would play in the lounge at the Golden Nugget. And as long as people put shots of tequila up on the edge of the stage, he would keep playing. And I remember one night he did like a 4.5 hour show.
Wow.
Wasted out of his face. But, yeah.
Well, it's a good thing he switched his drug of choice. He'd be dead right now.
Yeah.
What about music festivals? So far, they seem mostly hip-hop, pop, and electronics. Are there any in rock and roll?
Actually, Life is Beautiful is a great rock and roll, very diverse, but it's younger. It's not the older rock. But you have Route 91, a country music festival. It's all country. EDC is dance music and a little hip-hop. Los Rages is completely a rock festival. It's a new one that the D is doing downtown. So I think what Vegas is doing, I think what we learned very early on with Rock in Rio, is that there are only so many music festivals we'll be able to do. There's only so much demand for that, especially touring, because you still have Coachella, Bonnaroo. You still have another two dozen music festivals out there that you're competing with. So I think we will do, I think you'll continue to see more music festivals. I'd like to see more of a jam band music festival, like we did with Vegas back in 2005. I'd like to see a Hispanic rock festival. And I think what Derek Stevens is doing downtown is he's kind of got an incubator venue. When they did Los Rages, which was a 2-3 day hard rock music festival, the capacity is only 8,500 a night. So now you don't have to pay the acts as much, and you can do a modest festival. That festival in 3-4 years will be in another venue doing 15,000 to 20,000 a night. And the hope is then between the site that we have his site, we have the site across from Luxor, which is where we do Route 91. That's about a 25,000 capacity. Then you graduate to the festival site across from the SLS where we did Rock and Reel, that can do up to 50,000. Wow. And then you graduate to the big one out the Speedway, which can do 150,000 a night.
Wow, that's a lot of people. By the way, just as an aside, I heard today that EDC has moved from June back to May, which it always seemed insane to me that people were out there in June when it was
115 degrees.
Yeah, yeah. Even at, you know, after midnight, it's over 100 degrees out there. So
yeah, and I think the, you know, most of, I go to EDC every year, and in terms of crowd management, it's very comparable to the Grateful Dead. There are no crowd management issues. The issues really are more dehydration. And again, we only feed into, even though it's at night, I mean, it's all night. I'm really glad to see they're going back because that'll make a big difference in the safety of it.
The Raiders are coming to town. They're building a big new stadium. Do you see that as having an impact in, will there be rock concerts there, and how's that going to matter?
Absolutely. The one segment, when you look at Las Vegas, and you look at my job with Las Vegas events, is to go secure events for the destination. Well, we've basically been locked out of a whole segment of events because we don't have a competitive stadium. We don't have the capacity and a modern stadium in a good location. The new stadium is going to allow us to go after, I mean, there will be a Super Bowl. There'll be we will compete for a national championship college game. We'll compete for a semifinals. We'll compete for a Final Four. We'll compete for international soccer. There isn't anything that we won't be able to go after. Before, we couldn't say that. But concerts, Beyonce, we talked about Beyonce early, her tour was only stadiums. She didn't play arenas. So we didn't see Beyonce. So the fact that now we have a stadium that when Kenny Chesney, Springsteen, U2, they, you know, some years they're in arenas, some years they're in stadiums. We'll have a state-of-the-art stadium located in a perfect spot for a destination-oriented events.
So the stadium will lift all limitations on Vegas.
Yes. Again, anything you saw before, you know, we have been probably the number one event destination in the world And I say that because a lot of these cities will get the Super Bowl 1 year. They'll get the Final Four 1 year. The National Finals Rodeo is 10 days every year. The events that we do are events that are done every single year. Well, now we're able to compete for those events in which, yeah, maybe every 3-4 years, but in any given year, you could be doing a Super Bowl and a Final Four. So there's about 15 events out there that we can't compete for now, but we will be.
And like you mentioned, we'll be able to capture the stadium tours like U2 that I've never seen them come to Vegas since I've been here. That'll be a great chance to get to see some of those acts that we wouldn't get to see otherwise.
Ironically, this is the first tour U2 has not played Vegas. Last tour, with the Claw, they played Sam Boyd Stadium, and it was the smallest stadium on the tour, but they were very loyal to the city. They love Vegas, but it just didn't work out this year. If you had a stadium, U2 would have played Vegas.
By the way, did I hear right that Ringo Starr is going to do a residency here?
I don't know if it'll be a residency. A couple dates.
Ah,
you know, the okay. Key to a residency is a catalog. You know, Celine's a perfect example. She's got so many hits. J-Lo, Britney Spears. Their fans will travel, but it's because of the number of hits they have. Santana. So Ringo, even though he's a Beatle, he kind of uses a different mix of artists every time he performs. So I don't know you'd have the demand for Ringo to do 4 to 6 shows in a weekend.
What are some of the other potential residencies that you see for Vegas?
Well, I think it's anyone that has a lot of hits and is tired of touring. And that's really what it is. You can generate.
And doesn't like Branson.
Again, Branson is just a. Branson isn't going to generate near the revenue that Las Vegas is going to generate for an act. So the fact that there are these theaters that are now anywhere from 1,000 to, Madison Square Garden's looking at building a 17,000 concert-only venue, much like the Forum has become. So when you look at the niches of the different quality of the theaters, the capacities of the theaters, and the expertise that you have with these hotels in securing these shows, I think you'll see, just imagine somebody with a lot of hits, and as they, I wouldn't say even if it's as they get older, as they get tired of touring.
So with the addition of these new venues like the stadium and T-Mobile and some of these other things, maybe this Madison Square Garden thing, does that kind of phase out Thomas and Mack and maybe even the Grand Garden, Mandalay Bay type arenas?
Well, Thomas and Mack's already phased out for live music. And it's interesting because when we did Elton John and we did all of those shows, we only drew 5% of the crowd from out of market. And the ticket price was probably half of what you get at MGM. So now you go to MGM. When Grand Garden opened, and Barbara Streisand charged $1,000 a ticket, it not only changed the paradigm of ticket pricing here, it changed it across the country. And it worked. I think it was reasonable. People don't like the high price of tickets. But if you don't, one, we wouldn't be in Vegas, we wouldn't be getting these acts unless the tickets priced that way. So you'd be going to Phoenix and L.A. and paying for a flight and a room. And on the other hand, from an economic perspective, the fact that they do so well here, $7 million this Rolling Stones made for one night's work here at T-Mobile. So the fact that they can generate that means that there's more growth there.
There was an interesting piece in there, speaking of the high ticket prices, about the locals here in Vegas being able to afford the higher ticket prices. I was wondering if you could kind of touch on that for a second.
Well, again, I don't know that they can or can't afford these ticket prices because they are high. But if they really want to go see a show, what they would have had to do before is go to L.A. or Phoenix or Salt Lake. So they have the ability now to see a show they wouldn't see without traveling. And you may pick or choose your shows every year versus going to 4 or 5. You may go to 1 or 2.
What percentage of shows or tickets are comped by casinos?
I don't think it's as many as you'd think. And I think it all comes back to, you know, look at the rewards programs, and I think casino would spend what they normally spend for the points earned in the rewards program. But I don't know. I think even, there was a rumor when MGM, when Grand Garden opened, that the casino was paying for all the tickets. Well, the casino would help them along by buying 500 to 1,000 tickets. It would help them make the guarantees. But the shows made it on their own. So I think the tickets are used much. I think tickets for a Grand Garden show probably have the same system as stations uses. It's really based on what a customer is worth.
Yeah, and they've gotten stingier and stingier, so.
We're talking to Pat Christensen about his book, Rock Vegas, Live Music Explodes in the Neon Desert. And we're going to take a brief break for commercials, and we have lots more questions for Pat, so don't go away. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In September, there are two casino-wide progressives going at all times. The big one starts at 10,000 and must go off by 25,000. If you're playing with your card, at least $1 in the last minute, you get $25 of free play if somebody else has the nerve to hit the jackpot. The progressive then resets at 10,000 and begins to climb again. The second progressive starts at 1,000 and must be hit by 2,500. It's expected the smaller one will go off about three times per day. Week 8 of the free video poker classes, Wednesday, September 20th, NSU Deuces Wild. In my opinion, Deuces Wild is one of the more fun video poker games to play. It's the second most popular video poker game in the country, behind Double Double Bonus. NSU in particular, which stands for Not So Ugly, it was a spur-of-the-moment name that happened to stick, returns 99.73 with a 0.3 slot club. It's break-even every day. And when you include mailers, comps, and other promotions, it's positive every day. The classes will be held in the Silverado Lounge, which is the first lounge you come to, entering from the parking garage. If you're at least 21 years of age, you're welcome. The beginner's class is at noon. The intermediate class starts at 2 p.m. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. We're taping this show early, so I don't know what the game of the week is or what it's going to be when this show airs. So I want to talk about another game from videopoker.com called Wheel Poker Quick Quads. In this game, you get to spin a wheel whenever you end up with a four of a kind, called a quad, or a quick quad, which is three of a kind plus two more cards that add up to the rank of the trips, like 10-10-10-4-6 or 2-2-2-ace-ace. The average wheel spin is worth 157 plus coins. The best way to work out the strategy is to use the Wizard of Odds video poker strategy calculator in the quick quad section and add 157 to each of the values of the quad. That is, if quads normally receive 400 for, say, 4, 2s, 3s, and 4s, you enter in 557 into the software, which is free, it's online, and that'll take the wheel spin into account. The South Point has some decent quarter triple play versions of this game, and I will likely teach one of those next semester, which will likely begin in January. All right, we're back talking with Pat Christensen. I listen to music on YouTube and have noticed that when I listen to the same song more than a couple times, it goes into a YouTube-created mix, especially for me. So I hit one of the mix buttons, and it is 80% of songs that I've listened to more than twice, and 20% songs that I've never listened to before, but is generally
similar in some ways to what I have listened to. YouTube is one of the places that do this. Is this becoming more and more common?
Yeah, not only more and more common, it's the future. It is what music, it's the format all music will end up in. So if you look at the history of distribution of music, go back to the 78 record that literally was heavier than, I mean, you drop it and it would break. You have the 45, then you have the 33, the album that we all grew up with. Then you go to cassettes and 8-tracks, reel-to-reel, CDs. But they all had one thing in common. You had to go out and buy a fairly expensive, there was a fairly expensive start to it. You know, I think albums were $7-$8 when I was in college. CDs got as high as $16. So I think what Napster and a lot of these other music sharing forums created was demand for something that was a whole lot more economical. And the evolution has become things like Apple Music, Spotify. Actually, in the next gen, I forgot all about the what Steve Jobs did with iTunes, where you could buy the $1 or $2 record right off of iTunes. So we've gone through this evolution, and it's come to the point where streaming music spots, my favorite is Spotify. And what Spotify does is it streams, I don't know that there's a song that I would like to have that isn't on Spotify. When I was in college, I would borrow records from my roommate. I would record cuts, very, very time-consuming, but it was fun, on my reel-to-reel. So I'd have 3 hours of music, but it probably took me 9 hours to make. Now, for $10 a month, Spotify will play any, you can go to any song, you can go, if you have an inkling of a song, you walk out of here today, you say, I want to get in and listen to this song, you've got Bluetooth, you can literally fire up and listen to that song on the way home. But more importantly, what's happening with the algorithms of, which is what YouTube is doing. YouTube is taking what you like, and they are using algorithms to continually find new music for you to test. I'll give you an example. On Spotify, they have two things I listen to. One's called Radar Release, and one's called Weekly. Both of them. One is regular songs. They take. I've got probably about 3,000 songs I've listened to on Spotify. So they've got a good record of what I listen to. Well, they now recommend new songs that are out. That's new. Release Radar. And then the second one is just regular songs. So these algorithms now help me go find new music. Well, let me tell you where this is even going further. Spotify is done a deal with a ticketing company. And what they're doing is a recommendation for a show will pop up while I'm listening to it. So there's a show in town. Let's say it's Jackson Browne. He's playing at the Pearl. So that show will pop up, and it'll link me to somewhere I can buy that ticket right away. So the reason I'm so bullish on live music in Las Vegas is because these different platforms are allowing new artists to break. They're giving access to music you never had before. You'd have to go buy it, whether it was, or you'd have to listen to it on the radio. Radio became so commercial, you never heard new music. So now we've taken this full cycle where we're coming back to the 70s, but it isn't radio that's breaking them anymore. It's formats like Spotify, Apple Music,
Pandora.
And it will only get better as technology, and it'll get to the point. Shoot, I see a day where not only will they, if you're listening to it, say, in Chicago, they know you're a customer, you've been to Vegas, you'll get an offer from a hotel to come and see the show, to fly here, and literally could go right to that website at that time and make the transaction. So it is doing two things. Technology is, for $10 a month, I don't have to go buy any more new music. Everything that's new is going to be there. And not only that, it's helping me find new music.
I love that. My method of choice is Amazon. $8 a month. Probably doesn't have quite the selection that Spotify has. I have noticed a few songs that I've searched for that weren't there. but nearly unlimited. And like you said, I've discovered music that I would have never found otherwise, especially listening to the radio now, where you're hearing like the same 20-song set over and over again between commercials. Streaming really is incredible. I love the piece that you put in the book about that.
Andrew, you mentioned that you go to 6 or 7 concerts a year. Are you going to mostly arena shows or smaller venues or big festivals or what?
I have an affinity for the smaller shows. I just saw Simple Plan at the Brooklyn Bowl last week. It was incredible. So those smaller kind of venues like that. I saw Linkin Park at the Chelsea earlier this year. Those are the shows that I like to hit. I did see Garth last year at the T-Mobile, which was great. The sound is amazing in there, but I do lean towards the smaller shows. I think the sound is better. The intimate experience is something that you can't get for those big ticket prices. And
yeah, if we all had our way, Garth would be in a theater. Rolling Stones would be in a theater. But the economics of the live music business is they're going to go where they can generate the biggest buck. And so they gravitate to arenas and stadiums. But the fans prefer the theater experience. And second is the festival, because of the value, the camping. It's a whole different experience.
I was really kind of shocked that Bob Dylan is playing the Chelsea. I mean, is he really just lost his audience that much that he can play a place that small?
I don't think so. The Chelsea, I've seen some big acts go through the Chelsea. Like I said, Linkin Park was there just earlier this year.
How many does that seat?
Can go up to, I think, 4,000. Maybe 3,000, 4,000. It's a big venue.
It's an interesting venue too, and I've wanted to ask somebody. Maybe you know that there seems to be something about the floor there,
because it's on the third, fourth floor.
It bounces.
It shakes. It does. It's not you.
The floor, it's not the drugs.
The floor is moving.
It's almost like it's designed to do that. I thought that was really
cool. It bothers some people, and other people think it. I guess it depends on the show, but you're safe. You're not going to be on the second floor by the end of the show.
Well, that's good to know.
When you had some of these big act comings like Grateful Dead way back when, might have been scary because you don't know what you're getting. Do you ever go to other cities, pay for tickets, go around and watch the shows and see what kind of problems they're going to have and stuff like that?
When I was running venues, almost always, if we felt like there was something we could learn about the show, and it would be hip-hop. Remember rap, NWA, those were very, very controversial shows. We chose to do them because we didn't want to legislate morality. We didn't think the university was the place to, because the message wasn't so much about being unsafe as it was the message at that time. Like the Grateful Dead, we went to 2 or 3 shows before we went, but most of those were not because we were concerned about the operation. It was because we were trying to convince them to come to Vegas. But the management of to shows today is such a science. Rarely, unless, we've had incidents with stages. Stages having wind problems and stages collapsing, things like that. But crowd management hasn't become as much of an issue as it used to be.
Now, you are a middle-aged white guy.
Thank you.
And
for the middle age.
Oh, okay. You're welcome. I'm a teenager myself. A lot of music appeals to different ages. Do you have people on your staff like under 30 who like would have a much better feel for what the under 30 market is all about? Or do you listen to so much music that you think being an older, middle-aged white guy can deal with it?
So when I was at the Thomas & Mack, I would have needed the younger. But we don't really get involved in the selection of bands or anything for a festival, or even a festival. We have quality festival producers approach us about a concept, and the city then supports it financially, mostly through marketing the event. So Life is Beautiful was a concept that was brought to us by Tony Shea and Rayhan Chaudhry and Justin Winogur, and they had this concept. We bought into it. We supported it. EDC, the same thing. EDC had more of a track record, not necessarily a good track record, but we knew if it was managed properly, EDC was going to bring a crowd to Vegas. So our criteria when we look at events is really, are we working with a proven promoter, someone that has the ability to deliver on what they're doing? Do they have a track record? And is it the right, will it fill rooms? Is it the right genre of music? So we don't, you know, my staff, yes, I do have members on my staff that do have a whole different taste in music, but we more rely on the event producer for music festivals to select that. So the lineup for Life is Beautiful, there's not one act on there that this 62-year-old would want to see, except for Muse. Muse is a kind of a jam band that's the last act out of all of them. So, no, you don't want to rely on me because you'll have one genre of music each year.
Wasn't there a comedy festival within the last year also? Was that downtown on Fremont Street maybe? Or
I think we've toyed with a lot of comedy festivals. They're difficult to sustain because it's comedy to me is more, it's not like you might travel to see a Jerry Seinfeld or a big name act, but there are so many good comedy acts that are kind of spontaneous. You come to Vegas, you want to go see, you want to go laugh, you go to a comedy act. So we've not been successful at sustaining. I mean, HBO used to have a comedy festival they did at Caesars, but it's just difficult to sustain comedy festivals.
I want to ask you about something that you said about EDC, that it didn't have a good track record, but you mentioned that you kind of look at the promoter's track record in order to bring them here. So what made Las Vegas want to take a chance on EDC? I know you mentioned, too, that promoter since then has kind of become prolific.
Yeah, if you look at Pasquale Rotella's, you look at his story and how he has evolved and grown this dance music. There's nobody. I compared him in the book to Steve Jobs and Steve Wynn in his own genre. If you go to that music festival, it's like Disneyland for kids. He spends, I think the budget this year, God, I can't remember, it was $50, $60 million. But he has stages. His third stage is as big as Coachella's stage. And they are more creative by far. I mean, they're all built around this very this is sensory experience. You'll see characters. He has probably 50 to 100 characters marching through the festival, looking for people that aren't having a good time. So the attention to detail, the fireworks show is probably 100 yards long. That he fires this show and lasts for like 15 minutes. So Pasquale isn't so much about profit. He's about creating an experience. And what he learned in L.A. is, first of all, he needs to be in a better venue. The downtown was not Coliseum. A stadium really isn't a good venue for that. Speedway works great because it's all the 130,000 night all fit on the field. So, and it's outside of town, and if you go to it, if you're sitting outside the stadium, this is the EDM music is the loudest music you could ever hear. The bass on it moves the ground. It's so loud. But you can't even hear it outside because of the stadium walls, the seats. So, I think what we did differently, and Pasquale, you know, he came to Vegas, one of the things he said when he met the mayor, is he goes, I'm not in LA anymore. Because the mayor greeted him with a martini glass. He was welcomed here, whereas he was kind of like the Grateful Dead. He was chased out of L.A. But here, the metro, the way they manage events, and I use two as an example. One, New Year's Eve on the Strip. If you were down there 15 years ago, it was dangerous. Now, it's rather wild yet, but with the barricade and the plan that they put together down there, it's safe. You know, I'd let my kids go down to... my 17, 18-year-old. I'd let them go down to to that if they wanted to.
When you say it was dangerous, you mean because of the traffic?
Well, not just traffic. It's the way there was no real way to get to the crowd, to manage the crowd. So it was like bedlam. When they went to the two barricades down the middle, and the police officers were inside the boulevard. They basically were no more than 20 feet from anybody all the way down the strip. And so they were able, two things happened. By the fact that they were there, there really wasn't a need to do much. Just their presence meant, hey, behave. Well, EDC is the same way. You'll find these police taking pictures with fans more than you will see them resolving issues. And one of the reasons for that is told a story about Rick Nogas, who's head special events for Metro. That's his attitude. He does not want to come in to an event and have to control the event. He wants to manage it. So there's a plan, and his officers are trained to be to resolve issues, not make arrests. I think that's the difference in Vegas. For that event, it is the safety of those kids out there is much better than it was in L.A. And here in Las Vegas, it is much more accepted than it was in L.A.
I've been to big musical events in other cities. Been to Nashville during Fanfare, although they called it something else these days, but it lasts about a week. And I've been in New Orleans for Jazz Fest, which lasts about 2 weeks and has all kinds of acts all day long in a really big venue. Do you see anything similar to either one of those happening in Vegas? Or like week-long events or two-week-long events?
Yeah, eventually I do. I think as music becomes as music becomes more available, and you've got the rooms, you've got everything. We're going to do a music conference here in November. It's called Emerge, and it really is that they're going to be these up and coming acts are going to be playing different venues. The version of the CMA Jam, I think it's called Jam Fest now in Nashville. It's ACM. What we do is we put the acts now in venues. We used to do a couple festivals with them. We did it at Orleans. We did it at the Link, and then we did it at the Rock and Reel site. Now those big acts are playing with other acts in Chelsea, Pearl, The Joint. So, yes, I absolutely see promoters, producers looking at the venues and creating a different style music festival that is longer and envelops the whole city.
In some ways, during the rodeo, it's like that because there's country music acts all over town.
Well, rodeo is a great template for almost anything. If you can have one event like Thomas and Mack, where you've got 10 days of a sold out crowd, and create the type of experience with daytime events like Cowboy Christmas, the team roping out at the South Point, there are events going 24/7. In addition to the roadie, we probably bring two times as many people to town for the NFR as have tickets for the event. They're here for the party.
The free concerts and things going on Fremont Street and South Point.
Well, not everything's free, but the viewing parties are. So they get to go to these viewing parties where they win prizes. They get to meet the contestants. The viewing parties, all high-definition television, you know, anywhere from 4,000 to 1,000 capacities for their showrooms. And then, you know, whether it's George Strait, Brooks and Dunn, the number of country acts that are in town, plus all day long with Cowboy Christmas, Country Christmas, you've got something going 24/7 during the NFR. And again, you look at events, I don't know of a special event, the Super Bowl, the Final Four, a national championship game, where you have that much activity going year 24/7. There's a couple of reasons for it. One, the hotels, well, it's a 10-day event, and this is our 32nd year doing it in a row. In these cities, you go to it 1 year, and it's in another city. There's no way to get to build it, build momentum. Well, here, once we do an event, it's probably the worst year we'll have.
Well, like you said, we have the rooms to support it. I read an interesting thing the other day that Portland proper has 7,300 hotel rooms. And if you combine MGM and Caesars just alone, that's more than that. So we have the rooms to basically support anything, right?
It was funny because when the 1 year that ACM moved to Dallas, and we were kind of fighting for it to stay, my last comment to Bob Romeo, who produced ACM, who was the president of ACM at the time. I said, well, you can go, you can, your choice is this. You want to go to Arlington and do your show in a stadium, or do you want the city? So when you come to Vegas, the city is integrated wholly into the event. So now with the stadium, we have both. You have the city and the venue.
Now, we said at the beginning that you're president of Las Vegas Events. Is that a private for-profit organization? Are you working with the convention center or some other Las Vegas organization? What is that?
Yes, it's a private, nonprofit organization. The board is made up of six hotel operators: Caesars, MGM, South Point, Boyd Gaming, Stations. So you have the gaming, and then you have a couple members from the chamber. You have a couple members from the LVCVA. So we work hand in hand with the LVCVA, and our funding comes through the hotel tax. So the funding for the investment in these events comes from the hotel tax.
Years ago, in a lot of cities, Ticketmaster pretty much controlled getting tickets to places. How is that different today?
It's not. You have Access, which is AEG's. So you have Live Nation, who owns Ticketmaster. They're the biggest concert producer in the world. AEG is second. They have their own ticket company, Access. And there are a lot of niche companies that, especially for theaters and the smaller halls that have tickets, but Ticketmaster is pretty much the still the 800-pound gorilla.
So do they do the same way as they did 20, 30 years ago? Or, I mean, I've heard of StubHub, but that's more sporting events, but they're still a pretty big organization.
Well, StubHub is the 800-pound gorilla for the secondary market. So if you're reselling a ticket, StubHub. But Ticketmaster also has a reselling platform. Shoot, for the NFR, we have a reselling platform. We weren't completely for it, but we work with Prime Sport, and if fans want to resell their tickets, we have a platform to resell it. So has the business changed? It's changed dramatically. For a couple of things have changed. One, the ability to market these events through social media, through digital media, and then connect them to the ticketing company has changed. But what probably fans dislike the most is the economics of it. If you sell a $200 ticket, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get a $40, $50 service charge. And
if you're buying four tickets, you get it on every ticket, which really frosts me.
So, let me give you
need a smaller family, Richard.
let me give a little background. When that first started, I was just getting into the business. 1983, a guy named Fred Rosen, who basically created Ticketmaster, went to the venues, tied them up, and they gave me a quarter a ticket. I got a quarter a ticket for every ticket we sold. And through the years, that quarter has become 50 cents, a dollar, $3. So Ticketmaster isn't keeping that money. In fact, that money is getting split with the promoter, with the building, with the act. Ticketmaster just takes the full brunt of fans discussed over
it. Well, except if I want to go see a Cirque show and they want that $40 a ticket, but if I drive down to one of the MGM properties and buy the tickets there, I don't have to pay that. So the artist or whoever is making less?
Well, it's Cirque in this case. And what Cirque is saying, and here's what happened. The artist doesn't make as much more as you think. What they did is there was a time when the guarantees for these acts got so high, the promoters couldn't make a living. So rather than cut them out, the act chose to use Ticketmaster as a way to pay them. So when you're getting your rent or you're getting when you're getting the things you used to get back in the 80s, you're just getting them differently. And that's what's so absurd about the whole thing. What they should do is just be upfront, put it in the ticket. The ticket's not $100, it's $125. No service charge. But the acts want to keep their ticket as low as this paradigm. It probably, to me, it's the biggest problem in the music industry, live music industry today, is they could solve their problem, both they could solve their brokering problem by playing more shows. They could solve the disgust of the fan by just putting the ticket price in the ticket. So when you go to Cirque, you might be paying, you're not paying a service charge. You don't know what you're paying, whether it's, you know, whether the ticket's worth $100 or $125. You just know you're willing to pay that. And what they do, and they just can't, they can't find a way out of this. If they could just put the price of everything in the ticket. Ticket's $125. Not $100. It's $125.
It's a sacrifice because they want to have the perception of the low ticket prices, but they want to...
But the fans all know they aren't really low.
You're right. You're getting the disgust on the back end. Twice this year, I've went to concerts and got two $60 tickets, and my total was almost $200.
I almost went to the desert, the event at Coachella, that they had the Rolling Stones and the, what was the name of that? Desert Breeze or Desert... I can't remember the name, but it was a $1,000 ticket. The service charge was $250. So I said, no. That was where I... Now, if it was $1,250, I might have done it. But it was just the idea that you're paying and then paying, and you don't even... You are thinking Ticketmaster is getting it, and that's what the acts want. They don't want to take the... They don't want to take the heat.
That's what I've always thought until just now, that Ticketmaster was just reaping the benefits of these charges.
The acts aren't that kind.
All right. We've been talking to Pat Christensen. His new book from LVA. Check it out. This is not a normal gambling show, but it is about Vegas. And since it is LVA, and LVA is a friend of the show, that's why we have Pat. We're glad we did. Thank you.
And the name of the book is?
And the name of the book is?
It's Rock Vegas. And not only have I written the book, I'm following it up with monthly blogs. I've gone to shows like I went to Steely Dan, wrote a blog. I just went to Yes and wrote a blog. So you can go to rockvegasnation.com, sign up for the newsletter. And I'm continuing the book is, at least for a year, is going to continue through the blogs.
Very good. We've met Andrew Yule today, who I got a feeling we're going to be talking to him again down the road sometime. Thank you, Andrew, for showing up.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.